Well, my name is Jane McCurry, and I'm the Electric Vehicles Program Manager at Renew Wisconsin. I'm really excited to be here today talking about renewable energy and electric vehicles. It's really great to see familiar faces and some new faces in the room, too. We have a really great panel of experts today talking about how we can capitalize on the transition to electrified transportation and make sure that our transportation sector is powered by renewable energy. Our first presenter is Matt McGovern. Matt is an attorney at Von Breesen & Roper. He's a shareholder and registered Wisconsin lobbyist and the chair of the firm's Energy and Clean Technology section. He focuses his practice on energy and clean tech and government relations matters for the public and private sector. Matt, thanks for joining us.
Thank you all for coming today. And I'm going to start with a little, is this on? Is this working?
It should be on.
Okay. I'm just going to give a little bit of background on the state of the EV industry in Wisconsin and then discuss some of the policy initiatives that are out there. And then I'm going to, at the end, get to this question of how can EVs drive renewable energy in Wisconsin. So big picture, you know, globally, EVs are doing great compared to where they were before. There's about 2 million sales in 2018 worldwide. This is up from a couple of thousand in 2010, so huge growth there. Bloomberg New Energy Finance projects that by 2040, 57% of vehicle sales will be electric, and buses will be 70% electric. So, you know, there's a range of forecasts, and that's one of the more aggressive ones out there. And the reasons for this are really, they're driven by policy, but also the benefits that EVs have, which are, reduced carbon, reduced air pollution. They perform better. They're a lot of fun to drive. I've got a Chevy Bolt. I love it. It's really fast and a lot of fun to drive. Teslas are probably the best car money can buy. So in addition to being good for the environment, they're just a lot of fun and they're quiet. It's a better experience. But it is a lot driven by policy. And this is pretty typical of the automotive industry in the past 40 years or so. There's been a lot of regulation for clean air, and this is just kind of the continuation of it. So Wisconsin, we're sort of, you know, middle of the pack or behind a little bit. In terms of sales, we are at, we're 32nd in the nation as a percentage of sales. So if you combine electric vehicles and plug-in hybrid vehicles together, it's about 1%, it's still less than 1%. Despite them being cheaper to operate and cleaner and all the great benefits that they have. We're at about 1.07 registered EVs per 1,000 residents, which is the national average is about 2.2. California is the highest at about 8.5. California sales, new sales is about 5%. And so, we're a bit behind that, but the good news is that EVs are really popular in Wisconsin. There's a Yale Communications survey of support for energy efficient vehicles that found 81% support in Wisconsin. So that's statewide, not just Madison or Milwaukee. They're really popular. The other bit of good news for EVs is that we drive a lot in Wisconsin. So on average, 15,000 miles a year per driver. So if you do buy one, despite the upfront cost, it pays off faster. And so the policy limitations that have kind of held back EVs are the high upfront cost and the lack of availability of charging. And so the other advantage Wisconsin has from being sort of late and behind is we can learn from other states what's worked. And so we can look to California. I keep bringing them up because they've been doing this for 20 years. And, they've got a number of policies in place. The federal government has a $7,500 EV tax credit for some EVs. That's been shown to boost sales by 29%. We've also seen the experience in Georgia, which has a legislature more conservative, a little bit more like ours. They had a $5,000 EV incentive, which at the time they were one of the top selling, top EV states in the country. When it went away, EV sales dropped 90%. So we really know those kind of incentives work. And then some of the other policies California and other blue states have done have been to allow utilities to recover costs of EV infrastructure. which, you know, some of these things could also be done just at the PSC level under existing law, so that might not take such a huge change. One thing we've seen, though, in states that have done this is that the amount of money that utilities have spent on infrastructure is a lot lower than the new revenue they bring in. So that has the effect of putting pressure on reducing rates. So I think the study in California said it was about $40 million in expenses for two utilities. They brought in revenue from electricity sales of about $170 million. So, you know, when you're paying your electric bill, a lot of the cost is not really the electricity itself. It's the cost of the whole distribution and transmission system. So if you can have that spread out amongst a larger volume of sales, that puts pressure to lower rates. So some of the policy things we're seeing in Wisconsin right now are, you know, we heard a little bit this morning about the PSC investigation into EV policy. That is, the PSC is taking stakeholder input and public input on potentially making some recommendations to improve things that utilities would be allowed to do in terms of special rates for EVs or funding charging infrastructure and just kind of overcoming some of those barriers to adopting EVs. And we know those work because we've seen it work in other states. And then some of the bigger changes, like a, you know, like an EV purchase incentive, that would probably take a pretty big change in the legislature, which nobody's foreseeing right now. But you know, we're seeing a little bit more bipartisan support for clean energy and for EVs, and we saw some of that this morning. Representative Nealon has a bill, and he's a Republican. He has got a bill to spend $10 million of Wisconsin's VW settlement on building new EV charging stations on highways. So, you know, that could be really helpful. And then, you know, some of the bigger changes, you know, there's an election every year, legislature changes, there's going to be redistricting in 2021, so who knows what it could look like after that. And then finally, we've got the governor announcing his climate task force, which could come up with recommendations for things that the state could do in terms of boosting EV adoption by just purchasing vehicles for state fleets or putting more charging stations on state properties. So there's a lot of things that could come long-term and things that could be done under existing law with the existing people in the legislature and in the governor's office and the PSC. So there's a lot of really hopeful signs in Wisconsin for EVs, and I'm just going to get to now how EVs can drive renewable growth, which is the whole point of this panel. The big thing I see is that EVs, the big cost in an electric vehicle is the lithium-ion battery. And costs have dropped quite a bit, about 80% in the last 10 years. And so the bigger the EV market gets, the bigger that battery market gets. They'll have more factories. They'll adopt economies of scale like every other new technology. Lithium-ion batteries are also the same technology that utilities are using to add storage to the grid. So if you had a huge EV industry with 57% of the vehicle sales being electric, that would require a giant lithium-ion battery industry as well, which could make it a lot easier for utilities to add storage to smooth out the peaks and valleys of production from variable renewable energy sources like wind and solar. And then in Wisconsin, you know, in our region, the wind energy production is highest in the middle of the night, which is unfortunately not the peak time, but that's also a good time to be charging your electric vehicle at home using wind energy and using the existing assets of the current generation and transmission system. So EVs and renewables really go hand in hand long term. And one last thing that EVs can help do is it's this new huge revenue source for utilities. So, you know, just one EV, I ran the calculation on a Tesla website. If I bought a Tesla, I'd spend $650 a year on electricity living in Milwaukee. So if you multiply that by thousands and thousands of new EVs every year, that's more revenue for utilities. That puts pressure to reduce rates since it's letting them generate more money from the assets they have already, and then also just a healthier utility with more revenue, higher stock price, better credit rating lets them finance projects at a lower rate because they'll have the easiest time borrowing money. So they really go hand in hand, and with that, I think I'll turn it over to the rest of our panel.
Thank you so much, Matt, and a great transition to our next speaker. Deb Irwin is the Manager of Regulatory Policy for Xcel Energy. She manages policy for Wisconsin and Michigan and works on a variety of issues related to renewable energy, new technologies, including Xcel Energy's Solar Garden Program, their Renewable Connect Program, and electric vehicles.
So I'm going to talk a little bit about the utility role and how some of our goals and priorities kind of fit with electric vehicles. So some of you may know, and our president of the Wisconsin company was here actually at the Renew Summit last year talking about it. Last year, Xcel Energy became the first major utility in the country to establish a 100% carbon-free goal by 2050. We also have an interim goal of 80% carbon reduction by 2030. So, you know, Xcel Energy and a number of other utilities now have these clean energy goals and these carbon reduction goals. You know, we've been leading the clean energy transition for a number of years now, but to the point where the transportation sector has now surpassed the utility sector as the largest emitter of carbon in the United States. So as the electric sector is decarbonizing, mostly at this point as a result of renewables being cost-effective and cost-competitive with other resources, provides a really good opportunity to also decarbonize the transportation sector and sort of tackle that next big chunk of carbon emissions in the United States. So clearly, you know, the electric sector and transportation decarbonization kind of go hand in hand. So some stakeholders might wonder, you know, why should the utility be involved in this whole electric vehicle thing? You know, shouldn't the market do this? Or is this just something that utilities are going to spend money on that only benefits EV drivers? Well, you know, how you think about this makes a difference. And Matt talked about, you know, adding new load to the system and how that can decrease costs and rates for all customers if you're better utilizing infrastructure. But you have to be better utilizing infrastructure to achieve that result. If, you know, clearly EVs are going to add load to the system, and if you add that load at the wrong point in time, you could actually increase the peak, increase the need to build additional infrastructure, not have those cost savings that are possible, and not have those benefits kind of delivered to everyone. So, oops, sorry about your water bottle. So what can we do to make sure that we achieve those cost savings? There's a couple of things that utilities can do, and one is offer time-varying rates, right? So Matt talked about, you know, how much wind energy is available at night, and that's usually the cheapest time to make electricity and provide electricity. We want to encourage people to be charging their vehicles at night. We want to have utilities providing rates that are designed to send those price signals to customers, tell customers that it's, you know, tell customers when it is cheaper to buy electricity and when it is more expensive for the utility to provide it, right? So send, you know, having a rate structure for electric vehicle charging that incentivizes off-peak charging in a way that's just reflective of actual costs to the utility is something that benefits everyone. It will allow for more efficient use of the system. It helps us avoid needing to go out and seek new resources, build new infrastructure, and just uses that infrastructure better. The other huge role, I think, for the utility is in managed charging, right? So not only do you want to sort of allow customers to choose to charge when it's cheaper and try to send them those price signals, sometimes, you know, that needs to be controlled by someone like the utility so that, you know, you don't put too much strain on the grid at a peak time, right? And so to make sure that we're not overusing energy at peak periods of time, utilities have a big role to play in managed charging. There's other barriers. You know, Matt talked about the some of the barriers to transportation electrification. I think there's a couple that the utilities can play a really strong role in addressing. One is information. So not everyone knows how great EVs are. You know, we kind of talked, the panel earlier this morning talked about how, you know, not everyone knows how far technology has come, right? So the utilities are generally a trusted source of information that customers, you know, might come to us asking for information about what it means to own an EV. What does that mean for me? How can I save money? You know, is that a good decision? And so the utilities can definitely play an information role there. I think that's pretty important. Also in addressing the high upfront cost. So, and this is where I wanted to just talk for a minute about two programs that Xcel Energy has proposed in Wisconsin that are pending commission's review right now, and they're really designed to address some of this upfront cost issue. So one of the things that Xcel Energy would like to do is allow customers to come to us for charging infrastructure at home. So I've got just like two quick diagrams to show you what we're talking about here. So, you know, the cost of installing a level two charger in residential homes, something that a lot of customers might want so they can charge their vehicle a little bit quicker. There is, you know, an upfront cost associated with buying and installing that infrastructure. We are proposing that customers have the option for Xcel Energy to provide that infrastructure. We would own it. We would take care of operations and maintenance, and customers could pay for that over time instead of having that upfront cost to buy that infrastructure. We also, as part of that proposal, are using the charging infrastructure to keep track of how much electricity the customer is using so that we can actually put that electric vehicle charging on a time-varying rate without having to put the whole house on time-varying rates. So, you know, if a residential customer is concerned that they don't want to have to pay, you know, the highest price in the middle of the day if they're using electricity, but they know they can charge their vehicle at night and they want the advantage of the low cost of a vehicle charging, this allows sort of the best of both worlds. The other thing that we've proposed addresses kind of commercial, like fleet style charging needs. Again, trying to address the upfront cost of the infrastructure that's needed to charge vehicles and vehicle fleets. So here, we're not specifically focused on the charger itself, but on the make-ready infrastructure and distribution upgrades that might be needed to the system to accommodate a large fleet charging situation. So I can talk to you more on a break if you want to know the details, but essentially, we have proposed to change how we charge customers for distribution upgrades in a way that takes into account the fact that there is going to be new revenue coming into the system from that electric vehicle charging, to sort of give people credit for the new load and the new contribution that they're going to make to utility infrastructure and use that to lower their upfront costs and allow that to apply not just to traditional utility infrastructure, but also to make ready infrastructure between the meter and up to the charger itself. So these are some ways that, you know, utilities can think creatively about, you know, their role, the things that they can do to help accelerate and lower barriers to transportation electrification. And, you know, it's really, we want to use that infrastructure better. We want to bring those benefits to all customers. We want to bring the decarbonization benefits. We want to bring the cost-saving benefits to all customers. And the utility is really, like, central to achieving all of those benefits. And so that's why, you know, you see utilities like Xcel Energy making these type of proposals. So, thanks.
Thank you so much, Deb. Next up, we have Josh Cohen. Josh is the Policy Director for Greenlots, and he leads policy and regulatory engagement for the Eastern U.S. and Canada. Josh has worked at SemaConnect and the Business Network for Offshore Wind and has hosted clean energy podcasts, More Power to You and Offshore Wind Insider.
Thank you, Jane. Good morning, everyone. Can you hear me okay? That picture is about 5 years old. This could be an episode of Extreme Makeover. Like, this is before the beard and glasses. So anyway, one of my takeaways from this conference is I need to update my picture. Just a brief word about Greenlots. If you're not familiar with Greenlots, Greenlots is an electric vehicle charging technology company. Our product is software and services. And depending on what our clients want, we can provide them with full integrated, smart networked charging stations. We can provide full turnkey installation, or we can just provide the brains for those charging stations or the network to manage a platform. One of our best known clients is Electrify America. If you're familiar with their nationwide DC fast charging network, they hired Greenlots to both develop the app for the drivers, but also develop the network platform on the back end for Electrify America to manage that network. So just an example of how the electric vehicle charging industry comes in a lot of different shapes and sizes. So my high-level comments really echo nicely what Matt and Deb were saying. A couple key takeaways are that, yes, EVs have tremendous opportunity to be a beneficial influence on the grid to drive rates down and to integrate renewables. Point number one, absolutely, without question. But point number two is how we incorporate EVs into the grid is critical. And if we don't incorporate them well, it can actually have a negative effect and incur more costs than needed. Point number three is, how do we do that well? Manage charging, as Deb in particular was talking about with some of Xcel's proposals, and specifically technology-based managed charging. And the fourth quick takeaway is that even if we address the technological how to do it in the right way, we still need both a policy and an economic framework that values it, both the managed charging as well as the renewables, to really incentivize the adoption and integration. So I think most people here get the point Matt made earlier, which is the more EVs that are on the grid, the more electricity is sold, the more it at least has the potential to drive downward pressure on rates. And when you really look at some of the projections Matt was referencing, EVs represent the largest source of new load on the grid since the air conditioner, like transformational amount of load. So if we just charge up and put a bunch of charging stations all over the place without having visibility into charging behavior, and more importantly, without the ability to somehow try and manage or influence that charging, that's the wrong way to do it. Because right now EVs are at 1% in adoption. What happens when EVs get to 5% or 10%? And if a bunch of EVs are just charging up, whether it's a bunch of drivers coming home at night on their cul-de-sac and just increasing load at the street level, or if we're looking at the substation level or even at the grid level, you need the ability both to manage the rate of charging at that particular location as well as system-wide. And so Deb was talking about how time of use rates, time varying rates, are a good tool to do that. They provide a price incentive for drivers to charge up, you know, at nighttime when electricity is cheaper. You have the added benefit of being able to integrate renewables that are coming onto the grid at a time when consumption is generally less. But time of use rates are, in Greenlots' view, an important first step, but ultimately where we really need to go is managed charging. And what do I mean by managed charging? I mean technology-based managed charging. If you're familiar with smart thermostats, that's a good example. The paradigm we want to get to, and it'll be even more important to get to this paradigm when we get past all the EV geeks and early adopters, is to make EV charging as seamless as possible for the drivers. So that if I come home from work, I plug in my EV at 6 p.m., all I have to do is say, I want a fully charged battery when I leave for work at 7 a.m. the next day and not have to worry about it. And I'll have the confidence in knowing that my EV will be charged up, not only as cheaply as possible, but depending on how either I as a customer or the utility or the policymakers want to prioritize things, we can optimize it to prioritize renewables at the grid level, at a localized level. If we have issues with how much capacity there is that is non-renewable, we can prioritize emergency vehicles. I mean, there's all sorts of ways to prioritize how the where the power is coming from and where it's going. But the final key point is that, as I mentioned, for all of this to really happen, we need both a policy framework and an economic framework that really values the managed charging. And as Deb mentioned, when the price of electricity that the customer pays accurately reflects the cost of electricity, that's really where, number one, you see the greatest efficiency on the grid, but you also have the greatest value for managed charging. Because, and this is not necessarily an easy thing to tackle, but on the one hand, if we're trying to provide cost stability for customers, understandably, so that customers don't have a lot of fluctuations in the cost they're paying, and on the other hand, if we want to incentivize charging at times, not just through time of use rates, but like real time in 15-minute increments as renewables are coming on and then going off and coming on and going off, and incentivize that, we need both the policy to do that as well as the economic ability to really provide that financial incentive to the customer. So that's my high-level intro. Thank you.
Thanks, Josh. That was a great overview of the different ways that we can and should manage electric vehicle charging. Last but not least, we have Robert Fisher. He's the president of GTIMA, a technology and policy advisor to Mandalay Communications, and an associate editor of the SAE International Journal of Connected and Autonomous Vehicles. In these roles, he works to advance smart city standards, policies, and best practices as they relate to autonomous, connected, electric, and shared mobility.
Oh, I think the lesson for me is I need to diversify my tie selection. That's the same topic. So, as Jane alluded, I'm involved in transportation, but looking at it from a number of different aspects, not just...
Do you mind, recording?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I'm looking at transportation from a bunch of different angles, and automated, connected, and electric and shared vehicles are the main areas. And as the last panelist, I guess I get to tie a bow on a few important concepts. Number one, fundamentally what this is all about is trying to figure out how to decarbonize transportation. And the reason why is that in 2016 and 17, for the first time in the history of this country, the transportation sector outpaced all other sectors in terms of greenhouse gas emissions. Right? So if you care about transportation, if you care about the environment, you have to care about transportation. And number two is that, yes, electric vehicles are hyped and touted as a good technology for decreasing carbon emissions in the transportation sector, but there's a darker side to them. And before I say this, I will say that, you know, a lot of studies show that in the course of a whole lifetime, EVs are better for the environment than a standard combustion automobile engine. However, we need to talk a little bit about the timing here. So we know there's little debate that the production of an electric vehicle consumes more energy and contributes more to climate change than a standard diesel car or petrol-based car. Right. Now, the issue is, how long does it take to make up that deficit? Right. And so just citing a study that the World Economic Forum has kind of touted, you know, promoted, is that in Germany, where you have 30% of their energy portfolio is renewable, it, according to their study, it could take up to 9 years for that electric vehicle to break even with a diesel vehicle. And it was something like five or six to break even with a petrol-based car. Now, I just played with the numbers a little bit, and I applied them to Wisconsin, where we have 9% renewable energy in our energy portfolio. And if Wisconsinites are driving on average 15,000 miles a year, which we know, using the same basic arithmetic, it could take up to 375,000 miles to break even with a diesel vehicle, that's 15 years, or it was 180,000 miles for a petrol-based car, which is about 7.5 years. Now, that's kind of a dark, ominous study. There are some studies out there, these are hard calculations to make, some studies out there say that it could be as little as 2 years, et cetera. So there's a range, but the point is, pairing the electric vehicle with renewable energy is critical to the strategy of decarbonizing transportation if you're using electric vehicles. I will say there's some good news. There's other modes, there's a convergence of other technologies that are part of the transportation ecosystem in the future, right? So you've got automated, connected, shared. We're using this kind of catchy, phrase ACEs. ACEs is the future of transportation. It's the convergence of all these things. And the Energy Information Administration has they've advanced some studies that indicate that connected and automated vehicles could reduce fuel consumption by up to 44% by 2050. That's good news, right? Fuel consumption, we don't want that stuff in the air. How, you ask? Well, University of Illinois last year released a study in which they demonstrated in a simulated environment that the introduction of just one connected and automated vehicle in traffic could reduce consumption of fuel and alleviate congestion, but reduce consumption of fuel by 40%, right? So you may wonder, like, why is it that cities don't just, buy a fleet of, like, Pacer autonomous vehicles that would kind of go around the city? I mean, that could be an option, right? But Donald Shoup from University of California, he advanced a nationally recognized study that demonstrated that in one 15-square-block radius in or square-block area in downtown L.A., that congestion, up to 30% of congestion, was just folks circling for parking, right? So, yeah, that's right. And it led to, and I'm going to cite, these numbers are the correct numbers, 950,000 extra miles driven in downtown L.A. that year. That's the equivalent of 47,000 gallons of wasted fuel circling for parking, right? So, 4 trips to the moon, I mean, he did all the math, right? So, I mean, this is the conclusion. He won a bunch of awards for this, right? So where I'm going with this is there's three conclusions here. Is that, number one, if you care about the environment, you got to care about transportation. Number two, that, the future of mobility is not just electric. It's actually the convergence of these other technologies as well. And that's a good thing. But number three is that at the end of the day, you got a bunch of engineers that are trying to build solutions to these problems. But that's about all they do, right? It's our job to figure out how to implement these technologies so that we can mitigate the negative externalities of the technology. In terms of electric vehicles, there is a negative externality. It consumes a lot more energy to produce them. And what we do know is that a coal-fueled battery is dirtier than a wind-fueled battery. And so this panel and the topic here is, how do we pair, in this case, electric vehicles with renewable energy so that we can make up for that initial deficit? On that note, I'll just let that float and transition to discussion.
Thank you, Rob. And thank you to all our panelists. There are a few seats in the front, so if people in the back wanted to filter forward, you're fine to stand back there, too, if you'd like. How many people drove an EV here today? Awesome. Lots of hands. That's great. I saw a few when I was walking on the skywalk between the hotel and here, so that's great. We have some time for questions, so be thinking of any questions that you have for our presenters. I'm going to throw them one now as kind of a wrap-up to all of those great presentations. We heard a lot about different solutions to make sure that electric vehicles are good for our communities and are cleaning up air pollution and reducing carbon. We heard about different policies. We heard about utility programs, technologies that could help us manage charging and other transportation transitions that are happening. If you can give me 30 seconds on what you think the biggest opportunity is in Wisconsin in the next 2 to 3 years to make sure that we're making the most of electric vehicles.
I'll start. I think the next 2 to 3 years, we need to see a strong role for electric utilities, not only because that's the time frame of your question, but if you think about the state of the EV market, right now there's not a business case to profitably deploy charging infrastructure because EV adoption is so low. So the role for an Xcel today may be different in terms of, you know, helping deploy charging infrastructure 5 years from now. So really right now, and I talked about in my comments how EV charging and managed charging needs a policy and economic framework that values it. So when there's not a business case to deploy charging right now in general, when you add in the fact that managed charging is more costly, how are we going to do that? And that's really why electric utilities have a critical role to accelerate the market.
I agree. I don't know. I think we do. It is sort of that. How do you kind of get moving in this space in relatively early days? And I think as a business that has been around for a long time and will continue to be around for a long time, and a very kind of publicly oriented business as a utility, you know, you're trying to kind of serve all customers' needs. We can look at things a little bit differently than, you know, individual private company actors that might be, you know, looking at a shorter time frame to figure out what their action is. So, I think helping the utilities basically bridge the gap. You know, I mean, at this point, I think somebody said it earlier, maybe it was Chervak, that, you know, range anxiety is a huge issue, and so providing charging infrastructure is something that needs to be done. And so I think, especially when, and I don't think anybody said it so far, 80% of charging takes place at home. So for residential, you know, small vehicle, light duty vehicle travel that is electrified, 80% of that charging is taking place at home. You know, the utility is already providing service in homes, and I think is well equipped to address the charging needs there.
I also agree with both what Josh and Deb just said, and then I'd like to add one thing I forgot to mention in my remarks about what's going on right now and is going to be really big in the next 2 to 3 years is some of our transit agencies around the state are on their way to building bus rapid transit that will be electrified. And both in Milwaukee County, Madison, Waukesha County is looking at it as well. And then there are also, you know, every year, every municipality, every county, every state agency, all of these people buy vehicles, whether it's a garbage truck or a parking meter checker or a police vehicle. And the amount of, if you look at how much fuel a bus or a garbage truck uses compared to one person's car, it's astronomical. So these are things that we could be doing right now and that pay off in the long run. Local governments they're used to making decisions that pay off in the long run and maybe pay more attention to that than an individual would. So that's something that I'm hopeful that we'll see more of that right now and in the next 2 to 3 years.
I agree, and I just will summarize it all by reminding everybody that I need new ties.
Thanks, everyone. I think there's a big role for the consumer in there, too, to be demanding electric vehicles and driving more electric vehicles, talking to their utilities about what it's like to be an electric vehicle driver in their service territory, and talking to your legislators and elected officials about, you know, what you really need from them to promote electric vehicle adoption in your communities. At this point, I'd like to open it up to the audience if you all have any questions.
So I don't have an electric vehicle, but I'm going to be in the market for one very soon. And do I understand correctly that right now you cannot charge your electric vehicle from your home?
No, you definitely can. Almost everyone does.
Do you need a special plug or something?
Yeah, so...
So what's the difference between what you're talking about then and what... If we already have a plug...
So maybe what else do we talk for a minute about different types of charging infrastructure. So there are, at this point, about three different levels of charging infrastructure that people generally talk about. And the different levels have to do with how fast you would be able to charge and how much sort of power is coming through at one time. So you don't have to buy anything specific to, you know, generally if you buy an EV, you'll come home with something to plug it into the wall, and that may be sufficient for your needs. That, you know, sort of wall outlet equivalent is a level one charger. It may take, you know, 14 to 18 hours to fully charge a battery. That is completely depleted, right? So it, if you don't drive very far, yeah, that may be sufficient for your needs. If you want more like a, you know, maybe 8 hour, and please correct me, Josh, if I'm bad at my estimation here, but, you know, more of like an 8 hour, 6 to 8 hour charging for a full battery charge, that would be more like a level two charger. So that's the type of charger that I was talking about that costs money to buy. It's not just your standard wall outlet. It's more like an outlet that you would put in for a dryer. So it's like a 240 volt outlet. So that does cost money. You would buy that if you wanted a faster charging experience. And then the level three chargers are the DC fast charging that has been referred to. That's more of a, I'm on my way to someplace far away and I'm going to stop and charge my vehicle, and I want something akin to stopping at a gas station as an experience and not have to sit there for a number of hours to charge my vehicle.
I would just add, as a Chevy Bolt owner, I expected that when I bought it, I would buy one of these level two chargers, but my house is an older house, and just to do the wiring upgrade was way too expensive. So I just plug it into the wall, the regular outlet with the charging cord that came with the car, and it's fine for me. I don't deplete the battery every time I drive. It's 240 mile range. So, you know, charging nights and weekends is fine for me unless I'm doing a long road trip. And then I would add that on that car, there's still an $1,800 tax credit that expires April 1st, and there's some really good deals going on right now. And the Nissan Leaf still has the full $7,500 tax credit. So there's just when you're shopping around, just keep that in mind that there may be a tax credit depending on what kind of car you're buying.
Thank you.
Oh, lots of questions. I'll try to be quick. I have a question kind of from a different lens. So my organization helps businesses with sustainability, and I'm wondering in terms of sort of decarbonizing transportation on the big picture, what recommendations do you have for businesses that have fleets to take towards small steps if they can't, you know, electrify their fleet per se? What can they do to, what should they be focusing on really to help move things forward?
So fleets offer the best opportunity for large scale, one of the best opportunities for large scale electrification today. And as you know, fleet operators are about the closest thing to a rational economic actor we have, where it's like, what is the cost? What's the total cost? What's cheapest? And there are a number of applications, even for some medium-duty vehicles, where total cost of ownership, it is cheaper. So you asked, if we can't electrify, what do you do? I mean, my encouragement is to look at ways to electrify the fleet, take advantage of tax credits. The economics are already there today.
So something that Xcel Energy did over the last year or so was provide some funding to a number of our communities and kind of nonprofit-type customers to do analytics of their fleets to basically evaluate, you know, look at, put a device on the car, track its routes, track its usage, and identify which fleet vehicles are best suited to electrification out of a fleet. I think that type of analysis is, you know, really how you get from, like, I don't know anything about this to, oh, these are the vehicles that when they come up for replacement, you know, this is where I should be focusing on electrifying. That's where I'm going to get my most cost-effective investment.
Workplace charging is also super important. People who work at businesses or workplaces where they can charge their car are like 22 times more likely to own an electric vehicle. So if a business doesn't have a fleet or they have a fleet that it isn't possible to electrify right now, providing that infrastructure for their employees is a really good way to reduce their carbon footprint and electrify their communities.
I might add real quick also, you know, Zerology here in Madison, I don't know where you're based out of, but they just converted their fleet to electric, and they probably have some neat insight on how to finance that, and I'm sure somebody can help you connect with them.
That's a wonderful transition. We are out of time for this panel. It is lunchtime now. After lunch, you will hear from Zerology and many other companies that are working actively on this transition. Thank you all so much for being here. Thank you to the wonderful panelists. Round of applause. They'll be here for the afternoon, so if you have more questions, please find one of them or find me, and we'll see you soon. Thanks.